From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Brazil's president may be experiencing a change in fortunes. Since coming to power in 2003 with former President Lula da Silva, the party of the current President Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian Workers' Party, has led governments that have brought massive social progress to the South American giant, reducing unemployment and poverty by half and more than tripling spending on health and education. But lately things have not been going as well. The economy's faltering, inflation is on the rise, and leading members of the Workers' Party were implicated in the Lava Jato scandal involving the country's state oil company, Petrobras. In March, the right went on the offensive with a large anti-government protest. Following that, some of the more conservative sectors of Rousseff's ruling coalition broke off and joined forces with the right-wing Social Democratic Party, or the PSDB. Among those is the conservative head of the lower house, Eduardo Cumba, who's been considering impeachment proceedings against the president. The government's troubles have been widely reported and, according to some, greatly exaggerated in the international press, with the New York Times last week actually speculating that, quote, Rousseff's days as president may be numbered, close quote, in a piece that pictured Vice President Michel Temer as positioning himself for her impeachment. Another anti-Dilma march had been called for this past Sunday, but it appears the steam may have been drained from the opposition's machinery. That, according to Brazilian University professor João Ferreira Jr., who updated Telesur's Cody Weddle on the situation in Brazil.
I don't think there is a climate of general mobilization of the opposition. And the number of people in the streets is rather diminutive compared to the electorate. So I don't think that's such a mass movement as it's sometimes portrayed in the big media.
And can you speak about some of the divisions within the opposition, and specifically the position of certain business sectors such as the Sao Paulo Federation of Industry, in relation to those calls for Rousseff's impeachment?
Well, as a matter of fact, the Federation of Industry of Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro have come out against the impeachment of the president and any type of institutional upheaval caused, discontinuity. They are very concerned with the economic consequences of political instability. So they're not backing up this kind of protest. This protest is basically fueled by either right-wing small groups, social movements, or the main opposition party, PSDB. But not industry. Industry has backed up from supporting them.
And so let's look forward a bit. What can we expect in the coming weeks here? Will these anti-government demonstrations continue, in your opinion? And what about the supporters of President Rousseff? Where are they at? Will they be more active?
Well, I can't bet money they won't. What happens is that the timing of this demonstration was pretty bad, I think, for the opposition. Because they had planned that ahead of time, as usual. They have to do that when you want to plan a big demonstration, right? A wave of demonstration across the country. But the problem is that, right before it, in the 2 weeks preceding the demonstration, actually the president got, some sort of relief, both from the party system, because the president of the Senate has reached an agreement with her and are supporting her, and also, open letter from the industry association, also calling for more, political quaintness, for political conversation instead of upheaval and revolt. So, and it was right before the demonstrations. So, I don't think there's a general climate anymore for this kind of movement. Although, in the end, they had to go and do it. The people who were organizing it. So even the party that was backing it up, PSDB, now is split between people who are for impeaching the president and people who are against it.
But it's not only Brazil's current socialist president that's in the sights of the right-wing opposition. Former president and Workers' Party leader Lula da Silva himself recently had to sue four journalists and the editor at a right-wing magazine after it published a front-page special which attempted to link him to the Petrobras scandal. Lula led Brazil's economic boom from 2003 to 2010 and is still widely popular among the population, having had to step down due to term limits. The former president has also been a fervent supporter of Dilma Rousseff's administration. According to observers, his influence was decisive during the last presidential elections. The man affectionately known by Brazilians as Lula is also considered very likely to return as the presidential candidate of the Workers' Party at the next elections, leading many to believe that the right is trying to use the scandal to sully the image of not only the incumbent president, but her potential successor. 1 week after vowing to step down during a live television interview, the man that the West recognizes as Libya's prime minister, Abdullah al-Thani, issued an announcement Monday that he won't be resigning after all. Thani had previously stated he would present his resignation to Libya's internationally recognized parliament over the weekend. That sudden announcement was made during a heated television interview on a private broadcast station called Libya Channel, when, after being pounded with a barrage of tough questions on the state of the country, he said, quote, "People do not need to protest against me because I officially resigned from my position. They can bring a new prime minister with magic to solve all the problems," closed quote. After that announcement, a cabinet spokesperson, Hatem Al-Arabi, told Reuters that the prime minister had not officially resigned, explaining, quote, "A resignation needs to be handed in writing to the House of Representatives, which would accept or reject it," closed quote. The incident was the second time that Thani had vowed to resign. After his family was attacked in April 2014, he said he would leave office, though he changed his mind shortly thereafter. Since then, Thani's government has been battered with a series of setbacks. In August of last year, the prime minister and his cabinet were forced to flee from the Libyan capital, Tripoli, after a coalition of rival militias descended on the city. The troubled country is now divided between the remnants of Thani's government in the east and a rival administration that calls itself the General National Congress in Tripoli. The ongoing fighting isn't limited to the former capital. Fighting has been raging in Sirte, the former hometown of the man Libyans once called brother leader, the late Muammar Gaddafi. That city is now reportedly under the full control of ISIS. One resident of Sirte who wished to remain anonymous for security reasons spoke with RT by telephone Tuesday.
"What's been happening in recent days in the city is a real massacre, but the world is silent. The main blame lies with our politicians and members of the Libyan parliament. They haven't said a word about recent events. ISIL militants are killing people, driving out whole families from their homes. ISIL is in full control of Sirte city. I'm calling for help. We need to get children and women out of the city. There are no hospitals, no food, no medicine, no electricity, nothing. The situation is tragic."
Amar Amar, a spokesperson for the International Red Cross, told RT that the group had pulled out of the city and won't be back until the safety of its workers can be guaranteed.
"We have pulled out because our colleague, head of subdelegation, Mistrata, was killed in last year, and consequently, because of the deterioration of the security situation, all the parties who are present in Sirte and around Sirte should provide security guarantees to the ICRC, and then we'll look if the security guarantees are enough. If the situation is safe for the ICRC teams and its partners to operate, definitely then we'll consider our intervention."
Following the U.S.-led war against the country in 2011, Libya has become a failed state. Abiyomi Ezekwe is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He said the violence in Libya continues to be fueled by the West.
The Pentagon, as well as NATO, armed extremist organizations that served as a surrogate ground force during the war, beginning in February of 2011 and extending to October of that same year. They did not take into consideration that these are the same interests and the same social elements which they had described as terrorists prior to the war regime change in Libya. So by empowering extremist organizations, you only will come up with the result that you have now.
An outline for the implementation of a peace plan for Syria passed with a unanimous vote at the UN Security Council Monday. This month's council president is Nigeria's permanent representative, Ambassador Uche Joy Agwu.
The Security Council welcomes the Secretary General's statement of 29th of July 2015 that there can be no military solution to the Syrian conflict and reiterates its endorsement of a political solution through implementation of the Geneva Communique. The Security Council stresses that rapid progress on a political solution should include full participation by all segments of Syrian society, including women, and represents the only sustainable way to resolve the situation in Syria peacefully.
But although the vote was unanimous, not everyone supported the call for a transitional government that's being raised by some, in particular, the United States. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
The peace initiative is set to begin in September. It will set up four working groups to address safety and protection, counterterrorism, political and legal issues, and reconstruction. Meanwhile, Venezuela's envoy criticized the council for, quote, setting a very dangerous precedent. Rafael Ramirez said supporting a transition violates Syria's right to self-determination. The council has called for launching a process leading to political transition in the Arab nation.
The delegation of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, even though we did not block this statement and we went along with the consensus, nonetheless, we do not subscribe to paragraphs 8 and 10 of the presidential statement because we believe that these paragraphs violate the sovereignty and the right to self-determination of the Syrian people in promoting a political transition, including the establishment of a transitional government without its consent, and thus goes against the Charter of the United Nations. The legitimacy of government can be seen through respect for its constitution and the support of its people expressed through a vote within the framework of the sovereign determination of its political, economic, and social system. And for this purpose, Venezuela believes that the establishment of a transitional government with full executive powers in Syria violates the principles of the Charter of the United Nations, as well as that of states and respect for the self-determination of peoples, which represents a very dangerous precedent for international peace and security. This council must be impartial and objective in dealing with the Syrian crisis, disregarding, first of all, the legitimacy of the government of President Bashar al-Assad violates the sovereignty of this people in contradiction with the very presidential statement which has been adopted. This council could commit very serious mistakes in managing this crisis, motivated by national interests on the part of some of its members, in disregarding the weight and the importance that the government of Syria will continue to have in resolving the conflict. We are concerned by the fact that some members of the council have a double standard when it comes to assessing the legitimacy of a government or lack thereof. Therefore, we have to ask ourselves about the legitimacy of other governments in situations which are similar to Syria, which nonetheless enjoy the political support of these members of the Security Council out of national convenience. We have expressed on repeated occasions that a peaceful solution to the armed conflict affecting this brotherly country cannot take place without the participation of the Syrian authorities representing its own people. The government of this country is waging a tenacious struggle against terrorism, a terrorism carried out by violent non-state actors, of which it's been a victim as a result of the violent actions of ISIS, of the Al-Nusra Front, and the Conqueror's Army, among others. The fight against these terrorist organizations requires the authentic support of the international community to defeat extremism is fueled by chaos, hate, and intolerance. On the battlefronts of Syria, it's in the battlefronts of Syria where we see this bloody and terrible struggle against terrorism. If the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad was defeated militarily, the black flag of ISIS would fly over Damascus, inflicting a greater and horrific tragedy over the Syrian people, even worse than the current situation. Its devastating and destabilizing effects would be felt in neighboring countries, in the Mediterranean, and in Europe. we, in a responsible fashion, want to express our warning about the situation today before it's too late. Venezuela has stressed the need to avoid repeating the serious political mistakes that were committed in Iraq and Libya, where through false evidence using the argument of protecting civilians, a change of government was promoted through military means, which led to the institutional collapse of those states. And this was then exploited by terrorist organizations to promote, with the support of external factors, to promote their criminal agenda to the detriment of aspirations of peace, social justice, and development of their peoples. We think it's important to stress that institutional collapse in those countries has sharpened violence in the Middle East and in Africa due to the presence and the terrorist actions of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The weapons that were provided to these non-state actors to defeat governments are the same ones that today are in the hands of terrorist groups that are inflicting a tragedy on these peoples. We therefore demand that a stop be put to the financial and military assistance that is given to these criminal groups in accordance with the resolutions of the Security Council and of the General Assembly. Also well known are the reports of the use of chemical weapons by ISIS, which from every angle is a crime of war as well as a crime against humanity. And we unreservedly condemn these acts, and those responsible for them must be brought to justice, and they must account for these abominable acts. Madam President, the procedure applied by some members of this council to draft this statement lacks the inclusiveness which is required in every negotiating process. The elected members of this body, once again, were not invited to take part in drafting this document. We were given an already agreed text by the P5 so that the rest of the council adopt this document. This type of practice affects the transparency as well as the working methods of the Security Council, which acts on behalf of its member states, as established by the United Nations Charter. The unity of the Council requires the full participation of its members in crafting decisions on international peace and security, which are incumbent on all states of the international community. We repeat once again that this anti-democratic practice must end because it undermines the credibility and the legitimacy of this body. Venezuela, as an elected member, will always raise its voice and will always explain its reasons, appealing to the conscience of the international community and of the General Assembly as the body which contains the legitimacy of the United Nations. Venezuela, despite the fact that we did not subscribe to paragraphs 8 and 10 of this statement for the reasons I've explained, nonetheless, we do reaffirm our constructive spirit in not preventing the adoption of this document because we sincerely believe that we have to give peace a chance and we have to give political negotiations a chance. To conclude, our country reaffirms its full support for the diplomatic steps taken by the Special Envoy of the Secretary General for Syria, Mr. Staffan de Mistura, in whom we have faith due to his well-known diplomatic prowess and human qualities. We believe that he will be able to incorporate all of the parties in the negotiating process, including the Syrian government, in promoting a negotiated political and peaceful solution to the conflict. We reiterate our commitment in favor of sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of the Syrian Arab Republic, in keeping with the international law, including the Charter of the United Nations.
The conflict in Syria so far killed nearly 250,000 people and displaced some 12 million others.
The emphasis on the issue of Syria's sovereignty in the comments made by Venezuela's permanent representative was not a surprise to those familiar with his country's time on the Security Council thus far. When Ambassador Ramirez's appointment as the permanent representative was announced at the beginning of his country's term on the council in January of this year, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, said that Venezuela would focus on, quote, the Bolivarian vision of Chavez by accomplishing our task of defending the right to peace and sovereignty of the peoples of the world, closed quote. As we reported previously, Haiti had its first elections in 4 years last week, amid some reports of violence and of the disqualification of, depending on the report, between 9 and 14 candidates for their alleged role in it. But the reported violence wasn't the only problem. That, according to attorney Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, who was especially concerned about the lack of voting sites in poor neighborhoods. Speaking with Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford, Concannon said last week's election was the first time since the U.S.-backed coup and occupation of 2004 that the Lavalas Party, which used to command huge majorities at the polls, has been allowed to field candidates.
In terms of Election Day itself, the elections had many serious problems. There were problems with just getting material out to voting sites. Some places did not even have voting centers that were supposed to. One former internally displaced persons camp with about 100,000 voters that had no voting sites. There were also problems with materials like the ink that you're supposed to put your thumb in that's supposedly indelible was stopped that allowed people to vote twice. There were serious problems with observers where many parties were not able to get their observers credited, and parties close to the government seemed to not have those problems. There was also a violence on Election Day that closed down several large voting centers throughout the country. The Electoral Council said that the relatively small number, that only 4% of voting centers were closed down, but there were observer reports reported fairly serious problems at close to 50% of the voting centers that they observed. In terms of the lead-up to the election, probably the largest single problem was the growing level of violence, not systematic violence, but there were a lot of candidates who were attacked and shot at. Some of those rock attacks were shot at. Many electoral offices were burnt down, and that obviously affected people's confidence in the process and their willingness to vote. In terms of the candidates, it was the highest ever participation of political parties in Haiti's elections. I believe there was over 120 parties. And for the first time in a long time, progressive parties, especially the founding of the last party, which is traditionally Haiti's most popular, was allowed to participate. The last two elections, the Femme de la Valoise had been excluded for reasons that are not recognized by Haitian law. And so they were allowed to participate. There was a lot of exclusions of candidates on technical grounds that they didn't fulfill one of the requirements. Some of those exclusions are controversial, but it doesn't appear that the Electoral Council was following any particular political line in their disqualification.
Well, it seems like a big and very raggedy free-for-all. The Lavalas Party, in previous elections, of course, has commanded huge majorities. From what you could see, from what you could discern, what's their level of support today?
It's hard to say for sure exactly what the Lavalas' current level of support is, and I think we'll find out as the electoral returns come in. The party has been subject to a lot of repression over the last 10 years. Many top leaders were jailed, executed, or killed. Many have been bought off by other parties. And so it's a little bit hard to ascertain their support. I expect that they are probably the most popular party, but in the end, the electoral results are going to show that.
Now, these were elections for the legislature, much of the Senate, and all of the lower house. Why have they been delayed so long? They should have occurred 4 years ago.
Yes, the elections have been delayed, and that's led to a lot of problems. Haiti has not had any parliament at all since January, and for the last 2 years, parliament has been unable to take hard decisions because of a lack of a quorum. And that situation happened mostly because Haiti's president did not want legislative oversight, and his supporters in the international community supported that decision. And what Haiti's president, his name is Michel Martelly, has been doing over the last 3 years is proposing a series of electoral councils to run the elections. None of them exactly comply with the Constitution. And so he makes these proposals. The opposition parties and civil society predictably object to that. And then that ends up stalling for another few months until he proposes another electoral council. And throughout this process, there's been fairly broad opposition within Haiti for those attempts to manipulate the elections, but similarly broad support for the international community, especially the United States, has been very open, criticizing those who are opposing the electoral manipulation and supporting President Martelly. The underlying problem is that President Martelly was basically put into office in 2011 because the State Department and the Organization of American States forced the Haitian Electoral Council to change some electoral results, which put President Martelly into the runoff election for president, which he apparently won. As a result, he doesn't have that much popular support. The turnout in the elections, mostly because Assembly level laws and others were not allowed to run, was extremely low, the lowest turnout in the Western Hemisphere since World War II. I believe it was about 20% in the second round and maybe 24% in the first round. So you have someone who doesn't have a lot of popular support, is basically kept in office by the international community, and neither the president nor the international community wanted the referendum on policies that legislative elections would have given. During this year, as you mentioned, you could have legislative and presidential elections, and by the time you get a new legislature installed, it's going to be, at best, the last month of President Martelly's time in office. So he has effectively escaped parliamentary oversight for his term. But there is an effort to allow his party to continue to be in office, even though President Martelly cannot run for another term. And there is deep concern in Haiti that the international community is also supporting that. If you look at some of the electoral incidents that happened on Sunday, most of the problems seem to disproportionately benefit President Martelly's parties. And he actually has two main parties that support him, with a lot of other parties that were created by his friends to support them. And the incidents that seemed to support President Martelly were, first of all, it looks like the largest share of the violence was committed by Martelly's supporters. Second, the electoral offices that were shut down appear to be in areas where the government has the most opposition. Third, there's public financing for the elections, and those public funds were only handed out a few days before the elections, too late to be really used in any campaigns. But in the meantime, if you look at the posters around the country, if you look at the large campaign events, expensive campaign events run by the presidential parties, it's clear that President Martelly's parties somehow got some money to run their campaigns, even though the official public financing wasn't distributed until too late. So there's a deep concern in Haiti that you have all these irregularities that seem to help the ruling party, and the international community has been fairly consistent in downplaying irregularities. During Election Day itself, you were getting reports on radios, televisions, internet, social media, from a broad array of Haitian observers, international observers, Haitian press, international press, pretty consistently saying there's lots of serious problems. At the same time, if you look at the websites and the Twitter feeds of the international community, whether it's the UN, whether it's the U.S. government, or the official Organization of American States or European Union observer missions, they kept saying things are going well. In fact, the European Union observation mission put out a message saying that they are going very nearly normal. This is at a time where you had violence, you had burning down of voting centers, you had a large-scale intimidation. So this great concern in Haiti that what's happening is what they call it a coup d'etat electoral, that the government is going to try to stay in office by manipulating the elections, depressing opposition turnout, and that the international community is going to support that as it did in 2000.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.